some of the institutions that were caring for children also broke down, and many children took to the street and are taking on a life of their own on the street.
Right now, the Islamist forces are resisting, the Ba'athist forces are resisting, and there's real potential for them to get together and draw on the atmosphere of widespread popular discontent.
Where people get obsessed with wanting to know if there's any single reason for the imperial occupation of a country. There's no single reasons. There are usually, in most cases, 3, 4, 5 reasons.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, June 16th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon vowed today to press ahead with an assault on Hamas, and the Islamic militant group rebuffed Egyptian mediators' proposals for truce with Israel. With the peace effort stumbling, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas traveled to the Gaza Strip for a desperate push to persuade militants to lay down their arms. After a week of violence highlighted by Israeli airstrikes aimed at killing Hamas militants and Hamas suicide bombing in Jerusalem, with dozens of casualties on both sides, there were concerns that any further delays in violence could bury the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace and a proposed Palestinian state by the year 2005. Led by informants, U.S. soldiers swept into homes of Iraqis suspected in ambushes on Americans, rousing sleeping families and digging up backyards in lightning quick strikes to try and find heavy weapons and remnants of Saddam Hussein's regime. At least 28 Iraqis were detained, most taken away blindfolded and handcuffed in the sweep in Baghdad and several towns, but the U.S. military announced no major weapons discoveries, despite the U.S. campaign to put down resistance across Iraq's Sunni heartland, where Saddam's support was strongest. Attacks persisted. Insurgents ambushed 2 U.S. convoys, wounding 10 Americans, according to the military. Since April 14th, when Pentagon officials declared major combat finished in Iraq, more U.S. military personnel have died while occupying Iraq than in a year of occupying Afghanistan. That's according to Department of Defense figures compiled by The Globe. 56 U.S. troops have died in Iraq since the fall of Tikrit nearly 9 weeks ago, and the majority of those deaths have come in the past 6 weeks after President Bush's May 1st speech declaring that invasion operations had ended. Since then, 46 deaths have been reported among U.S. forces, including 11 from combat wounds. As the process of rebuilding and so-called nation-building in Iraq continues, the streets remain in a state of unrest, and the country still has a vacuum of power left by the removal of Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party leadership. Speaking with the London Independent newspaper over the weekend, former Iraqi Foreign Minister Adnan Pachachi, who's expected to play a significant role in Iraq's transitional administration, warned that the country needs some sort of government within the next 3 weeks if it is to avoid falling into complete chaos. For analysis, Peace Watch spoke today with Dr. Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. We asked him about the future of post-war Iraq and whether he agrees with Pachachi's assessment.
It's hard to know, to make predictions that narrowly about the future, but I have to say the pace of reconstruction or even of rebuilding the basic operations of government is not going slower than expected. It's going slower than any decent person would have wanted. But I mean, if you look at the way that the administration has conducted the whole occupation, they didn't plan for any of this. They planned for a quick, easy military victory, and they made no plans for such basic things, you know, required by the Geneva Convention as restoration of basic services like water and electricity to the Iraqi people. So, you know, there, among other things, and less, much less reported than all the violence, is there's a cholera epidemic in southern Iraq, and it's been an epidemic status for the last month.
So you're saying it's not slower than expected because there was no expectation of how long it would take and no plan in place, basically, to do anything.
No, yeah, they called it liberation, but there was no plan to do the most basic things for the Iraqi people. And so far, the occupation authority, in all of these other terms, in terms of provision of basic humanitarian services, has been significantly worse than the government of Saddam Hussein, and that's saying a lot.
Well, what about the increased military activity on the part of the U.S. forces in the region that's taken place over the past week or so? Immediately after the fall of the Baathist regime, some Iraqis were cheering and parading through the streets in certain parts of the country. Is the tide, however, starting to turn against the foreign occupation, especially in light of incidents like Friday's military attacks on 7 people in response to a tank ambush in the city of Balad?
Well, I think that it's not so much the tide beginning to turn. I think that people confuse two different things in some of the reporting. So people were very happy in Iraq to see the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, but right from the beginning they were saying this should not be an occupation. So, in fact, within days of the end of the war and beginning of the occupation, you had demonstrations saying, no to Saddam, but also no to the American occupation. And that sentiment is continuing and growing, and it's now taking two forms. I mean, there's the coordinated or somewhat coordinated military strikes, and there's also the huge peaceful demonstrations of a kind Iraq hasn't seen in a very long time.
Also, a lot of the reports allude to Saddam loyalists that are responsible for the ongoing fighting and the skirmishes. Is this a guerrilla war, or is it something different? Are these the people of Iraq, just the average citizens that want their land to be unoccupied? How do you assess that?
I think it's something that's evolving, and what we're seeing is yes, there are some remaining Saddam loyalists, some or really not Saddam loyalists, but Baath Party loyalists. Saddam has lost his coercive power, so these are people who still really believe in the Baathist ideology. There's also they're coming together with Islamist forces, right now the Islamist forces are resisting, the Baathist forces are resisting, and there's real potential for them to get together and draw on the atmosphere of widespread popular discontent, and you could see this growing into a real guerrilla movement. It's not clear that it will, because the United States is repressing it with great force, but it is really a possibility.
And we've heard reports about the U.S. military responding to a lot of these attacks, of course, defending themselves in some instances, but it becomes questionable in other cases. For example, 5 victims of one family, it's been revealed, were killed by a U.S. attack, with an elderly shepherd, his 3 sons, and a son-in-law. Are you familiar with that report?
Yes, and I mean, look at similar things like the big attack in which roughly 100 people were killed. Of the prisoners taken, 60 of them were released by the U.S. forces, who said that they were of no use to them. Now, if those 60 who were captured were of no use in fighting this insurgency, how many of the people who were killed were also of no use and really not involved? There's real questions, and this is added on top of over 50 people who were killed while peacefully demonstrating in cities like in Mosul, in Baghdad, and in other cities across the country.
Dr. Rahul Mahajan is the author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Among those concerned about the health and welfare of the Iraqi people is UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. The organization recently issued a press release raising concerns about child sickness from diarrhea and related diseases in Iraq. Peace Watch spoke with UNICEF's regional communications officer, Anis Salem, and asked him to describe the group's findings.
We're seeing an increase in the average rate of children who are coming down with diarrhea. Now, diarrhea is particularly dangerous in this situation because the temperature is extremely high, the sources of water are polluted, it's very difficult for the health structure that is not fully functional to cope, and the result of this, unfortunately, reflects in high rates of malnutrition and eventually in a higher rate of child death.
How much of an increase
has
there been?
Well, let me give you a number of figures. For example, last year we had just under 30 cases of cholera. Now we see a few weeks ago we already surpassed 50 cases. So that tells us that something is wrong. We also have indicators from some of the health centers, one particular health center, for example, in the south, where the number of daily cases of severe diarrhea that are being seen are about 50. Last year, this time, that health center was seeing 50 cases a month.
And so what do you attribute this dramatic increase to?
We have seen the breakdown of the supplies of fresh water. The water purification stations, the sanitation, the stations that deal with sewage, both of these have been severely damaged by a combination of the war, years of neglect, the sanctions, and of course the looting that happened after the war. And these four factors together have meant that the supply of fresh water has been badly affected. Children have to rely on polluted water. There is a lot of contagious diseases in the region. And as a result, vulnerable children come down with cases of diarrhea. They then get dehydrated because it is hot and because there is no proper treatment. And that means that very rapidly a child can move from being a healthy child to being a child that comes down with diarrhea to a dehydrated child, a very badly malnourished child, and perhaps, if no attention is given, a dead child.
UNICEF spokesperson Jeffrey Keel told the BBC that there are some 500 breaks in Baghdad's water system alone that are leading to contamination with sewage. Can you give us a progress report on the rebuilding of Iraq's infrastructure by U.S. and allied forces?
Well, I can't talk about what the allied forces is doing, but I can tell you a little bit about what UNICEF is trying to do. We are trying to do a number of things, and they are designed to improve the water and sanitation situation. One thing is to supply chlorine into areas where the water cleaning, the water purification pumps are operating. In some cases, as in Basra, that chlorine stock was completely stolen after the war. So that is one important area. The second important area is tankering in large amounts of water into southern Iraq from Kuwait. And that is designed really to supply emergency water, particularly to hospitals, health centers, populations that are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The third area is to help with the rehabilitation of some of the water and sanitation stations. We can't handle them all. We don't have that kind of resources. But in some of them, we are engaged with water engineers. I must say that the UNICEF-supported water engineers continued to work almost every day during the war, and they were trying to keep those water stations operational as much as possible. Unfortunately, the situation today is still in the balance. There is a lot of work to be done. It will take time, and it is important where there are urgent needs, hospitals, health centers, women and children, it's important to reach those.
Anise, when you say that you can talk about the UNICEF efforts that are underway, but not about what the military is doing, is the allied forces, is that because it's not clear that they're doing anything, or you're just not informed about what they're doing, or are you all working alongside one another and trying to rebuild this infrastructure?
Just to me, it's not clear, but I know that there is an effort to coordinate in various sectors. On the ground, in terms of day-to-day work, there are teams working together, exchanging information. I know that there is an effort. We read in the newspapers about large bids, large contractors coming in. I personally am not informed about this.
Are you concerned at all that the rebuilding process isn't happening fast enough?
I think the focus for UNICEF now is the emergency needs rather than the reconstruction phase. The most important thing that will help us with our work is making sure that we have security. If we have security, that will encourage many things to operate and to work. Let me give you just one example. When we in UNICEF are very keen on getting the educational system back to work, to getting children back into schools. Definitely, security allows children, particularly girls, to feel safe about going to school. So that is a key priority. We think that areas that relate to children, whether they be nutrition, supply of therapeutic milk, supply of high-energy biscuits, operating the 3,000 community centers that survey children and identify the ones who need special attention because they're badly malnourished, getting the 500 or so health centers to work properly, and getting the 65 hospital centers that deal with severely malnourished children, getting those operational, getting the backbone of the health system that basically addresses the needs of children to work again, that is a key priority. So it's basically getting children back into school, getting the health system to operate, addressing issues of malnutrition, trying as much as possible on the water and sanitation front.
And finally, Anis, we know that UNICEF issued a separate press release raising concerns about the exploitation and trafficking of children that it fears may occur in the near future. What's the basis for UNICEF's concerns, and what can be done about it?
Well, in an environment where there is a lack of security, with many children taking to the streets, unfortunately, some of the institutions that were caring for children also broke down, and many children took to the street and are taking on a life of their own on the street. We know that under these circumstances, children become more vulnerable. We know that more vigilance is required to protect these children.
Are these orphans?
It would be a good idea to raise the alarm, make the various organizations and institutions around the world who guard against child trafficking to bring this to their attention.
Are these orphaned children that you're speaking of? Or
some of them are orphans. Some of them are destitute and poor children. Some of them are children who are pushed onto the street because they have to feed their families and end up as street kids. Some of them have taken on bad habits of sniffing glue, for example. We read a lot of reports now about children on the street sniffing glue. That sort of thing raises our concerns and motivates us to ask for more efforts to protect children.
Anis Salam is UNICEF's Regional Communications Officer. We reached him at his office in Amman, Jordan. Tariq Ali, political commentator, author, and TV commentator, speaking at the University of California.
We meet at a grim time, if the truth be told. And I'm not one of those who likes to excite people by projecting a fake optimism. So I think we have to be very clear that what we've witnessed over the last few months is a very grave event. It's the occupation and recolonization of an independent sovereign country by the United States of America, backed by Britain. And this event, I would venture to predict, is going to form and draw the dividing lines of the 21st century. It's one of those events. It may seem trivial, and no doubt soon it will disappear from the American media altogether, like Afghanistan and Kosovo before it, which you rarely read about these days. But don't let that deceive you, because though that will happen and they will move on to other more interesting things, what has happened in Iraq is not going to go away. It's going to mark both the Arab world in which Iraq is situated, but the world as a whole. So the subject of this lecture is war, empire, and resistance. And all these three words are intimately related to each other. Wars, till 1914, were largely wars fought between empires. And you can start with the Roman Empire, if you like, and one lesson one would draw from that particular empire, something I was reading recently, was quite striking in relation to Iraq, where people get obsessed with wanting to know if there's any single reason for the imperial occupation of a country. And I always say one shouldn't be too instrumentalist about this. There's no single reasons. There are usually, in most cases, three, four, five reasons which explain the exercise of imperial power. And I was reading an account of the Roman occupation of Britain long years ago by Tacitus, in which he describes a conversation between the Roman proconsul in Britain at the time, Agricola, and one of his advisors. And he says at one point Agricola turned and looked at the rough maps they had of the time and pointed in the direction of Ireland and said, "What is that?" And it was pointed out to him that this was an island, you know, not far from the Roman-occupied Britain. And he said, "Do we occupy it?" And his advisor said, "No, we don't occupy it. It's worthless," he said. "The people are primitive. There's nothing to offer. They're marshlands. We sent people to look there. It's not worth occupying." And Agricola replied, "But I think this is where you're wrong, because an unoccupied land gives ideas to people who live in occupied lands." And it's interesting to look at that, because this is something which happens again and again. And of course, the Roman Empire was constantly engaged in wars with the Persians, with other rival empires of one sort or the other, till they overreached themselves and imploded. And that is still now, that has been the history of empires. And nor is it the case that it's only empires belonging to different religious beliefs. Of course, in the old days, they didn't have the religious beliefs of the monotheistic religions. But you had long battles in the 16th and 17th centuries between two big, giant Muslim empires, the Ottoman Empire, based in Istanbul, and the Safavid Empire, based in what is now Persia. Big clashes, big battles for land, for territory. That's one of the last times on which Baghdad was fought over, in the middle of the 16th century, when the Ottomans wrenched it away from the Safavids of Persia and took it. So it's a city with a history of imperial occupation, wars, and resistance, which goes a long way back. Or you had the wars of the big nomadic expansions. And that was also brought back to me when I saw and read the accounts of the looting of the museum in Baghdad and the burning of the library, with the reporters writing about old documents, early 19th century, 20th century documents of the Ottoman period lying half-burnt, torn on the pavements of Baghdad. And that brought back memories of the 13th century occupation of Baghdad by the Mongols, who stormed it. But the Mongols were a people without a written culture. They were people of an oral culture. And they did not like the written word. So whenever they occupied countries, one of the first things they destroyed was libraries and books of learning, because they saw these as a threat. So not that that justifies it, but can we argue that the American Empire too is increasingly an oral culture without learning? But it isn't, as you know full well. It's a modern empire. So why did it permit, and we now know that this was permitted and tolerated, the library to be burnt in Baghdad again, which has a meaning which goes very, very deep in almost any culture, the burning of libraries, the looting of ancient artifacts. It's almost as if to punish and humiliate not just the leader they have overthrown, but the whole culture, to say we can do it. This is what's happening. This is who you are. And we are watching this happen. So the history till 1914, almost till the First World War, was a history of inter-imperial conflicts, or as it was later to be described, as inter-imperialist contradictions. And the last time the big empires took each other on, it led to the loss of 10 million lives. European lives, largely poor lives, working class lives in the main, as workers donned uniforms and at the bidding of their leaders, both conservative and labor, socialists, self-acknowledged socialists, went and slaughtered each other on the battlefields of Europe in 1914. And then something changed. And that change, and incidentally, it was that particular war which brought the American Empire onto the world stage. Because prior to that, the American Empire had largely concentrated on occupying Latin America, what we call Central America and parts of Latin America. And I would recommend a very good book to you, those of you who are interested in that period of pre-1917 imperial occupations by the United States. It's a book written by, ironically enough, by a very gifted Marine Corps General Smedley Butler called War as a Racket, in which he actually explains what he had to do as a Marine Corps general in the interests of the big American corporations. I note, and I just note, that this is the Bechtel Engineering Center. So the description by Smedley Butler is a very graphic one, and, you know, it's one side of imperial occupations, which we all know, but we tend to forget. And he describes what he and the Marine Corps were made to do on behalf of the giant corporations who dominated Central America and some parts of Latin America, toppling regimes at will, occupying countries, defeating Sandino in Nicaragua, laying the basis for much that was the mess that was to follow later. He said, it's like a racket. And he compared what they did to the mafia and the gangs that emerged in American cities during Prohibition, and gives very vivid descriptions and analogies of these two things. But it was not till 1917 that the United States entered the world stage. And it's very interesting if you just look at the period they decided to enter the First World War in April 1917. This was 3 months after the February Revolution in Petrograd had toppled the Tsar. There were many indications that the Habsburgs were about to fall. The big empire, the Austrian Empire, was about to fall. There was a great deal of unease in Germany itself. There were mutinies in a number of armies. So they knew that it was an uneasy situation. But what's interesting is that the decision of the United States to intervene in the First World War, almost simultaneously as that decision was taken by Woodrow Wilson, there was an emergency meeting taking place of the Central Committee of the Bolshevik Party, underground, clandestine at the time, where they were discussing a set of theses written by Lenin calling for the Bolsheviks to seize power. So the timing and almost the parallel decisions being made are quite interesting, because these two then, the American Empire and the victory of Bolshevism in 1917 in Russia, played on each other for 70, 75 years that followed, launching an epoch of wars, revolutions, cold wars, which came to an end in 1989. And so the purpose of that intervention was to try and sort out the world as the United States grew into maturity as a gigantic capitalist state with enormous resources. And these resources were then used in their own interests, but not simply in their own interests. And this is what makes the American Empire a very interesting object of study, that they decided basically to take the leadership of the capitalist world and to give it leadership in order to do battle against the new enemy that had emerged in Petrograd in 1917, and after 1945, even more significantly, with the wave of colonial and nationalist, national liberation revolutions which swept the world. It's impossible to understand our history without going back and seeing what took place in that period.
Tariq Ali, political commentator, author, and TV commentator, speaking at the University of California. Production assistance was provided by Maria Gilardin of TUC Radio. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. Başlar karanlık
Sunağım durdum, havlarda sunağım durdum. Gören ay terk